Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of the Rewatch Project with Hannah and Mike. I am Mike here in Wellington, New Zealand, and with me, as always, is Hannah. How the heck are you?
I'm well. Ready to podcast.
Ready to watch some Twin Peaks. We have reached the 10th, I want to say, episode of season 2.
Yeah.
Hannah, tell us a little bit about this episode.
This episode is called Dispute Between Brothers. Synopsis says, Leland is laid to rest and Sarah Palmer tries to accept all that has happened to her family. Dr. Jacoby returns from Hawaii. Cooper prepares to leave Twin Peaks. Mayor Milford objects to his brother's engagement to a younger woman. It is directed by Tina Rathbone and written by Trisha Brock.
Okay, I think she's a first-time writer on the show. I think this is the first episode that she's written.
It is the first one she's done. She did two episodes, this one and The Condemned Woman.
Okay.
Which is episode 16.
All right.
Yeah.
So I think this is very much the beginning of like phase 3 of Twin Peaks. I think that you've got season 1, which feels very much like it was all created in this one creative burst.
Mm.
And then you've got the sort of season 2 so far, which has a very particular, quite genre tone about it. And then we're now moving into this third phase, which is a much more, I suppose you could say, purely soap operatic element of the show.
Yeah.
You know, it's much more, I guess, in line with shows like Picket Fences and, Northern Exposure, you know. It's more of a quirky town show as opposed to a murder mystery. So that's going to be interesting. And then, of course, I think the next phase you've got is Fire Walk With Me, and then you've got The Return. So it's always interesting and exciting when we're moving to a new area. But before we get into that, we will remind you that we appreciate feedback, which you can send us at rewatchprojectpodcast@gmail.com. Either just send us a traditional email or you can record a voice memo and send us that. And also we can be reached by via Twitter and Instagram, where in both cases we are at rewatchproj. And if you listen to us on YouTube, then please do feel free to comment and we can read those out as feedback on the show as well. Check out our friend shows, namely Chinstroker versus Punter, His Film, Her Movie, Film Bastards, The Good, the Bad, and the Odd, Talk Without Rhythm podcast, and Video Game Landfill, and reviews on Spotify and on Apple Podcasts, or your podcatcher of choice would also be appreciated. So, Hannah, do we have any feedback today?
Yes, we do. We have an email.
Did this come in today?
It did. It is entitled, Thank You. Hi, both, and Happy New Year. Not sure when we are supposed to stop saying that. I just wanted to write to you as I'm a big fan of your show. I shattered my leg last year when I had an accident on my mountain bike.
Christ.
I'm all good, well, getting there now, but have been bedridden and decided to do a rewatch of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and looked for a podcast to listen along to for company. Convalescence can be lonely. I have just finished the rewatching and many, many hours of hanging out with you guys and wanted to thank you. I know this will sound corny, but you have kept me company during my recovery and genuinely helped my mental health.
Aww.
I have never written to a podcast before, but felt I had to acknowledge how much time I have spent with you. Don't mean that to sound creepy. And how much fun it has been going on this journey with you, particularly hearing about your accident too, Hannah. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is such an underrated show, and I love how much you talked about, in my words, premium cable shows with their endless budget, short seasons, long shoots, and lack of censorship restrictions are kind of the spoilt children of television. And shows like S.H.I.E.L.D., X-Files, Buffy, etc. really had to do more, much more, with less, much less. But, like your podcast, came to feel like family because they didn't just pop up for a couple of months every couple of years. They were always there. Looking forward to what you do next. Enjoying listening to the Twin Peaks episodes in real time. And yes, Hannah, watch Farscape. Hell, I will deliberately bust my leg up to listen to that.
Don't say that.
Kidding, but you get my point. Be well and speak soon. Sean from Hollywood, California.
Oh, that's so nice.
That is the loveliest email. Thank you so much, Sean. And from one busted leg to another, yeah. I hope you are very much on the mend and back to mountain biking.
Because did you bust your leg during the podcast?
Yeah.
It was during it, wasn't
yeah.
it? Yeah. Wow. And also, I noticed...
And herniated a disc in my back.
Yeah. Oh, like... I wonder... Sorry, what was the feedbacker's name again?
Sean.
I wonder if, Sean, did you wipe out going cycling in the hills in Hollywood? Because I've heard they're meant to be bloody treacherous.
Mm.
People have died hiking out in the Hollywood hills. Like, was it Quentin Tarantino's editor died? She was just going hiking and didn't come home.
Oh, wow.
And apparently it's quite a common thing in Hollywood for people to just go missing in the hills because they've... twisted their ankle, can't get a mobile phone signal, and just like dehydrated.
Well, isn't that 127 hours? Was that around the Hollywood area?
I've never seen it, but it was...
All I know is a dude got his arm caught and James Franco had to chainsaw it off or something.
Yeah, in fairness, James Franco and the dude were the same person.
I know.
You make it sound like James Franco, the actor, happened across this hapless fellow.
And just chopped his arm off.
Just like, I can shut your arm off, mate.
Yeah, don't worry. I fully understand what you mean about convalescence being lonely and also what a strain on your mental health it can be to be recovering from something, especially if it's something you've done from like physical activity, because as well as not being able to go out and do your day-to-day stuff, you have that endorphin crash as well from not being able to exercise.
Yeah, it's like you're suddenly not having sugar.
Yeah, and I really struggled with that, and you know, it sounds like
and also Sean, I don't know Sean's personal circumstances, but I'd imagine also if you live alone, that would be really difficult because you can't get out.
Yeah,
and TV and that point about the whole familial relationship, I think that is, you don't see that as much with modern dramas.
No.
Because, well, for the exact reasons that Sean said, I couldn't have put it better myself, is that they're so transient, whereas, like, you know, when I was a kid, Kirk and Spock were there every week.
Spirk and Cock.
Spirk and Cock. Skulder and Mully, you said as well.
Yeah.
Dr. Hugh. Dr. Hugh Laurie? Or what are you? No, But you don't feel like that about, you know, Walter White or Tony Soprano.
No.
I mean, partly because of the nature of the characters, but, you know, in the 90s, you felt like that about Mulder and Scully. Well, you felt like that about
not even Picard just or... in the 90s. I mean, you and I are watching X-Files at the moment, and we're on season...
We're on the penultimate season.
Nine?
Yeah.
Is it season nine we're on now?
Season eight.
Season eight. And... you're already saying, what are we going to watch after this? Oh, yeah. God, what are we going to watch?
I mean, it's like, I think when you do a big rewatch of a show...
lots to go.
And you get to the end. On the one hand, it's quite liberating because you're like, okay, I can now go on to other things. And that's great. But there is something very... that's why I understand why people get so hooked on like reality shows and cooking shows and things like that, because they pump them out.
Yeah.
And that's why classic sitcoms have such power, and people forget that, how nice it is when there's a show like Friends or The Big Bang Theory or whatever your poison is, to have that, because, and particularly sitcoms, which are largely the same locations over and over again, like, you know, Central Perk or the coffee shop in Frasier or whatever it might be, you inhabit that over a long period of time. I mean, think about something like Friends. That was a place that people went to every week for 10 years.
Yeah.
And that's a really powerful thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure I will give Farscape a watch at some point, so don't worry about that. Please don't bust your other leg. just to...
or the same one again.
Or the same one again.
Well, I would hope that because Sean has watched all of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and listened to all the podcasts. Now, you can't do that overnight. So I would hope and assume that Sean's convalescence is at least coming to a middle, you know. So let us know how you're getting on and let us know.
And thank you so much. It's such a lovely email to receive. And I genuinely, we really appreciate hearing from you guys, you know, knowing that there's people out there listening and enjoying and feeling some sense of comfort from us is why we do it.
Well, it was always the intention of the podcast that it be evergreen, that it be like a library of stuff that people might go back to or, you know, do a rewatch of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. in 5 years' time and find the podcast and listen to it then. So hello from the past, if that is the case. That was Hannah's sex sound. I don't know why she's doing it now. Hey. It seems a bit out of context, Hannah, but whatever. She's doing the Zoidberg dance from Futurama.
My attempt to do the Wayne's World.
The flashback. That's everything. Okay, well, yeah, no, thank you, Sean. That was really nice. And it isn't weird. And I feel the same way about podcasts that I listen to as well. You know, I think everybody does that.
Sean, full disclosure, when I checked the emails and I saw it had come through, I had to try really hard not to just reply back to you and go, oh, I hope your leg's okay.
Yeah. That's it. You got to kind of game face. But we hope you're doing well and we hope to hear from you again. Please, listeners, do follow Sean's wonderful example and feedback to the show. But should we hit pause? We shall watch the 10th episode of season 2 of Twin Peaks, and then we'll come back and tell y'all what we thought about it.
Please do not ever say y'all again.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, and welcome to Film Bastards, a podcast where three friends, two of them married and two of them podcasting life partners, chat everything from new releases, trailers, news, and an eclectic mix of other film goodies. Oh, and many, many, many tangents. You can find them by searching your podcast provider or check them out on Twitter and Instagram by searching Film Bastards. You never know, you might like it. And if you don't, well, we don't really give a f***.
And we're back. So we've just finished watching the 10th episode of season 2 of Twin Peaks, A Dispute Between Two Brothers. Hannah, initial thoughts?
This was the most soap opera-y type of the second season, in my opinion.
Okay.
Very like scene, end scene on a cliffhanger, scene, end scene on a cliffhanger. Mm-hmm. And like I liked it. It's not that I think that's a bad thing. I just noticed it a lot in this episode. It feels like because they've stopped having a murder mystery to solve, they're setting up a lot of other things. So a bit like in a soap opera, we have a climax to a big whodunit or whatever. Then suddenly you have, you know, set up a relationship between these people and set up a drama between these people and have this character disappear, have this character return. And they've had all of that happen. So, it was good. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, it almost feels like the first episode of a season in a lot of ways. I really like this episode. And I think that time has been kind to this episode because I think the conventional wisdom is that the show takes a dive after they find out who kills Laura Palmer. And I don't think that's true. And in some ways, I think this is the point in the show where Twin Peaks becomes a true cult TV show. Because Twin Peaks was immensely popular, but there was a lot of culture tourists watching the show.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit like, you know, when a band puts out a really popular album and then they often will follow that up with an album that's maybe truer to them and they kind of lose fans. But often bands do that deliberately to a certain extent. Like Nirvana following, you know, Nevermind within Utero. You know, really. And Springsteen following Born in the USA with Son of Love. A lot of bands scale back. Now, I don't think that's what the show was doing, but I think what happened was, I think a lot of the audience left the show when the Laura Palmer storyline was over. And I get that, because that was what the show marketed when it came out. Who killed Laura Palmer? You know.
See, I like to equate it to sex. So you've had lots and lots of foreplay. Everybody climaxed and found out that Leland was the killer. You smoked the metaphorical cigarette, and now you're just waiting to be able to go for a second time.
Yeah, and I think that and that works as a metaphor. Where this becomes a cult show for me, though, is this is the part of Twin Peaks that really only the hardcore fans were watching.
Mm.
And that doesn't make it better or worse. I'm not talking about from a quality perspective, but I think that this is the kind of the secret club era of Twin Peaks in some ways.
Don't you think any TV show, like, I think the same can be said for Fringe, X-Files, even Agents of
S.H.I.E.L.D. But with Twin Peaks, it was so sudden. It was literally from one week to the next, but it, gone,
like,
audience.
All of those really good TV shows that have a really loyal fan base do get to a point where they're like, fuck it, we're only writing for you now.
But that's usually a process of atrophy.
Mm.
Whereas here, it's like it's a different show in some ways. And, I mean, like, The X-Files is a good example, because we're at the point where there are new cast members coming in and people are coming and going a little bit on the show. And The X-Files was popular until the end, but really, the end of season 7 is when most people went. Because most people heard David Duchovny was leaving the show, and they were like, oh, okay. So we're getting to the point now where the Fonz isn't in Happy Days anymore. You know, that was the feeling. And I think Twin Peaks was a similar thing. But this benefits from rewatch, because I think at the time, because you've had the engine of the show removed, that narrative drive of who killed Laura Palmer, and it was kind of pushed on the show, so they didn't have time to load the torpedo bay with the Windham Earl storyline, which I think if they'd have known they were going to have to do it, they would have started the foreshadowing of that earlier, so it could have slowly transitioned into being about that. But basically, the show's kind of left with dick in its hand for a few episodes. And I think that watching it now, knowing where the show goes, it doesn't matter. But at the time, I do remember thinking, gee, this feels a bit directionless. It feels like the show's just now luxuriating in B-plot. But when you know where the show goes and you know that it does find its way back, you can just kind of enjoy this era.
Yeah.
You can enjoy. And what I think really works in this episode, and this era, this weird, there's about a 2 or 3 episode period between the Laura Palmer storyline and the Windham Earl storyline, where it is pretty much all B-plot. But I love that, because it feels like Portlandia or one of these shows that's just a tableau. You know, it feels like we're just hanging out in the town.
Yeah.
And that's an element of Twin Peaks. That's one of the many elements of Twin Peaks, but it's one that I really like.
Mm.
I like it in the show when it just moves around the town and follows the characters and puts combinations of characters that you haven't seen together and see what happens. And this episode does that a lot. And also, I think,
like Bobby and Audrey.
Have they even been in a scene together apart from like the funeral?
Yeah.
And I find that really interesting. But also, I just think that, and I've compared it a lot of the time to like sketch shows where, sure, the show doesn't have the narrative drive that it had during the first half of the season at this point. But all of the scenes are these great little music and performance-led mini short films almost.
Yeah.
And I think this episode has a lot of really nice performance-led scenes that do feel just like sketches, but not sketches in like a sketch show way, but literally in an art sort of, you know, just sketches of moments and great little pieces of writing and short filmmaking. And I think when you know that that's not what the show's going to be, and that this is kind of a a breath between storylines, you can relax into it and enjoy it.
Mm.
But I do remember at the time, as into the show as I was, thinking, well, what are they going to do? Because I remember when I first saw the trailer for Twin Peaks, I was like, well, what is this show? Is it a miniseries? Because I knew it was a murder mystery. And I'm like, well, you kind of like a murder mystery go on for like five seasons. Because sooner or later, the mystery will be over. And the FBI agent has to go home. You know, so this was the point in the show where I was like, well, what are they going to do? Is Cooper leaving the show?
Yeah.
Is Twin Peaks going to continue without Cooper in it because of the crime? Was he just there because of that?
It's like a conduit.
Yeah, but he's like the lead actor in the show. So I remember there just being a kind of a sense of, I like this, but what is it? What is this show now, you know?
I mean, that we've said this loads of times as well, that that is the benefit of this whole rewatch project, is when you know something is good, you're far more likely to just sit back and luxuriate in it. And, you know, we know what's coming. So, you know, you don't get quite as uptight about the seemingly trivial scenes, because up until now, everything has been super meaningful. And it's, I'm not saying that the stuff in this episode wasn't meaningful, because there's plenty of stuff.
No, but there's lots of kind of art for art's sake.
But yeah, there's plenty of, like you say, a day in the life of Twin Peaks. But I think, you know, it adds to the ingratiating yourself into Twin Peaks and sort of, you know, hanging out with Riker and his...
Yeah, that's exactly what this run of episodes is. And it's a little bit like, I mean, Twin Peaks is a lot of things. It's a gothic mystery series. It's horror. It's comedy. It's soap opera. It's surrealism. It's all of these different things. But for a large part of season two, it was a gothic detective show.
Mm.
And I feel like it's quite nice to shift the focus to some of the other elements, because what I think happens with Twin Peaks a little bit is, in the first season, it's a combination of all of those things all the time.
Yeah.
Whereas the second season feels very much like, right, we're going to have a run of episodes that are this tone, this part of the show, and then we're going to do a run of episodes that are this. And the kind of quirky, comedy, endearing, weird town element of sort of soap operatic, paint and place element of the show is what we're in at this point in the show.
Yeah.
And I quite welcome that at this point, you know.
And what you were saying about it all being sort of B-roll characters and things, it was so refreshing, because they're all characters that for a long time you've been thinking, I wonder what's happening with X, Y, Z.
Are they even in the show anymore?
Yeah, so it was really nice to have an episode where they're all featuring.
Yeah, and it was really nice to get that scene with Catherine Martell telling her story and just watching it and going, oh yeah, Piper Laurie's a really good actress.
Yeah.
You know, and just getting to kind of, it feels a little bit like they're letting the cast and crew kind of jam a little bit.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, hey, just, you know, do your thing because you're good and we enjoy you, you know. And I think that...
I really like the camera usage that they had in that scene as well, how, like, the camera was almost like on a semicircle going around Truman.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
While she was speaking, and yeah, well,
they seemed as interested with him as they were with her.
It was just a really interesting way to shoot him, and like, I'm not usually one to really notice camera stuff that much, but I enjoyed that.
And it feels almost like the perspective of the show's changed a little bit. Like, it almost feels like before there was always a sense that we were slightly in Cooper's perspective. We were coming into the town, whereas now it feels like our perspective is the perspective of the town and Cooper is almost secondary.
Yeah.
You know, and I quite like that. Like the fact that, you know, you get a lot of scenes with, you know, like for example, the the scene with Truman and Piper Laurie's character, with Catherine, it felt like it was the town reasserting itself. Like, if you look at the pilot, the town's this weird place that we kind of don't understand.
Mm.
And we come in with Cooper and we're trying to figure it out.
Mm.
But now, particularly with this episode, it makes you feel like you're really entrenched in the town and you're just kind of part of the furniture of the place.
Do you know one thing I realised I hadn't seen for a long time as well was Donna's dad, Doc Hayward, smile. Like, when he's smiling about the brothers having their ludicrous fight at the wake, I just realised I hadn't really seen his teeth.
What the other thing
for a lot of episodes.
The other thing is, as well, is that so much of the storyline in the first half of the season, because they were forced to expedite it, was taken up with the Laura Palmer storyline. But a lot of characters in the town who really make up the fabric of the town and kind of give the town its oxygen have had to be sidelined because they're not directly involved in the storyline.
Yeah.
So it's nice to get to spend time with people like Donna's mother again.
Yeah.
You know, and these people who are really great actors and who were there in the first episode, but who've kind of, just sort of evaporated. You realise how some of them, bloody hell, Russ Tamblyn, who plays Dr. Jacoby, his hair's grown since he was last in the show.
He looks like he's had an absolute glow up since we last saw him.
Well, should we get into the breakdown?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and I've got the note here about how this is the point where it feels like, this is the X-Files after Mulder leaves. This is like, if you're still watching the show, if you're still watching How I Met Your Mother in season 9, you're probably going to watch it to the end.
That is a fucking slog season. This is not.
No. But you get the analogy. It's
yeah, but like I think almost anyone watching How I Met Your Mother by season 9 will hate watching it.
Yeah, although I liked the last few episodes.
There was a lot of Shawshank before the redemption.
Yeah, there was. There's a really nice establishing shot of a road in the town at the beginning of this episode that I've never seen before, and I don't even remember that shot. Mm. And I like they've still got B-roll that they can bust out every so often.
The running tap.
That was another one as well I've never seen before. That was a later one. That was the one I was talking about. But yeah, there's a few there. I suspect that maybe at some point, at this point in the season, they sent a second unit people off to Snoqualmie.
Get some ambience.
Go and get some more. We keep having to use the same shot of the Great Northern.
Yeah.
So it's 3 days later, we've had a time jump, and we get all the stuff in the early scenes at the wake I really love.
I love the fight.
You've got Sarah refusing to be drugged.
Yeah.
You know, she really wants
Cooper and Sarah in that first scene are lovely.
Yeah. Mm. And Cooper talks about how there's, things dark and heinous in this world that we can't, tell our children about.
Mm.
And that Leland, fell under the influence of one of these when he was young.
Mm.
And, you really get a sense of, how tragic Sarah is. Like, she's like, I'm going to bury my husband next to my daughter now.
Yeah.
You know, it's like she is the most tragic character.
Well, she's one of the biggest victims.
Yeah.
And how awful must you feel to have all of that going on and not be able to stop it or even know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's inconceivable. And Cooper tells her that Laura forgave Leland in the vision. And there's just nice quiet moments, like when she says, Leland could always find the other earring, and just that, the mundanity of loss.
Yeah.
You hear about that. I remember seeing an interview with a woman whose husband was a firefighter who was lost in 9/11.
Mm.
And it always stayed with me because it wasn't emotional. It wasn't this overwrought kind of manipulative, music in the background interview. She was just they're asking her what her life was about. And she's just like, well, I still do all the same things. I get up in the morning, I get the kids to school, I do this, I do the washing. But he's not here.
Mm.
And it's that kind of almost like the mundanity of loss.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that you do get on with it, you do get on with your life.
Well, you have
But it will never be the same again, you know. And I think that this scene conveys that really well. And I think also one thing I really noticed from this episode, where obviously they're having to tread water a little bit, is how much of a resource Angelo Badalamonte's music is.
Mm.
Like, so many scenes in this episode are juiced by the music.
Oh, you know, the music is a constant in this episode.
Yeah, it's there's some music playing pretty much
the whole way through.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that took me a really long time to get used to in season three, was there's hardly any music in the first few episodes.
Mm.
But as the story gets closer and closer to Twin Peaks and we start spending more and more time in Twin Peaks, there's more and more music in it. And then by the time you get to the last two or three episodes, there's music throughout the whole... Mm. And it's as though, again, it's the oxygen of the show slowly finding its way back in,
Back in.
You know, that's why it's called The Return. It's like not just the return of, hey, the show's coming back. That's a sort of metaphorical thing as well. So Cooper says that he'd be honored to drive her there. We see Hank doing lots of his usual performative nice guy. And I love the way that Audrey just sees through him. She's just like, this guy. And I've got a note about it's nice seeing all the town together again. We see Ed and Donna have a nice moment as well. We see Jacoby and Briggs talking. So it's nice again. We're getting these secondary characters are starting to drift back.
Yeah, where's his
into
wife?
The show. Whose wife?
Jacoby's.
She's at home. We see the two brothers fighting. And it's really funny as well.
I love that little bitch slap he gives them.
Yeah, and the kick as well. It is old man. But you've got Dwayne Milford, who's the mayor, who we've seen before. We saw in the pilot. And then we've got Dougie Milford, who is runs the local newspaper.
Mm.
And he crops up again in a couple of episodes. But he's this kind of secondary, silly character. And one of my favourite things about Twin Peaks is, obviously, we've been waiting 30 years for it to come back. Mm. But about 6 months before the show aired, Mark Frost's book, Twin Peaks, The Dossier, came out, which was like a prequel to the show. And it's like a history of the town. It's not that guide thing I showed you. This is like a proper big novel. And us Twin Peaks fans, you know, ravenously devoured this because it was the first new Twin Peaks we'd had in 30 years. And it was canon and it was going to be, and it had characters in it that were in the new show but who weren't in the old one. So it was all that kind of stuff. But the main character in it is Dougie Milford. And you learn that he was like a fox molder. He worked with Briggs secretly, and he was involved in Project Blue Book and Roswell and all of these things, and knows all about all. And I just remember at the time thinking, what a fucking insane, to take this really silly character who was only in a few episodes during a run of the show that people dismiss, and in the first bit of new content that people have had in 30 years, make him the main character. Is just so audacious and insane.
Yeah,
that they would do it. I like the way that Briggs talks, the way that he says to Cooper, and they kind of cut from the same cloth, I think. Mm. Like he says, "I'd like to invite you to an evening of an incredibly pleasant evening of fly fishing." And Cooper responds with aces.
Aces.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, they're just on the same wavelength, aren't they?
And he used to say aces.
Another thing I love about this episode as well is it's all of Cooper saying goodbye to the town.
Yeah.
Because he never really gets to do that for real in the show later on because of what happens with the storyline. So it's quite nice that we get that, you know, that we get to have those moments, even though that it's a bit of a cheat.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it starts with him saying to Truman, I'm going to really miss this place, when he's sort of looking around and just soaking up the eccentricity and the kind of small-town foibles that are going on there. We see the scene where they're trying to admit a 33-year-old to senior class with Nadine, and I can't help but feel...
I just have to give a special mention, shout-out to the guidance counsellor being the guy from Weekend at Bernie's who goes mad in the end and ends up in a straitjacket because he can't kill Bernie.
Wow, and props to you for... noticing that.
You underestimate how many times I've watched that.
Well, I won't make that mistake again. I can't help but feel that this whole subplot is kind of commentary on the fact that they've got like actors in their 20s at high school.
Mm.
It feels like it's very much like, I remember seeing an interview with Harley Payton or Robert Engels talking about their plans for season 3. And they were talking about there being a time jump, but still having like Bobby Briggs at high school and stuff like
that.
Like about how they were brainstorming ideas to kind of have fun with the idea of the ridiculousness of that. And I feel like this episode's sort of like kind of
Bart
doing
Simpson
that.
Still being at middle school.
Yeah, exactly. And so Audrey comes to say goodbye to Cooper. And it's a really nice thing. You get to see how much she's matured.
Mm.
And this is where we start to get a little bit of backstory. We get to see a little bit of the darkness and regret from Cooper, where he talks about how his attachment to somebody led to them being hurt or killed.
And the introduction of where Windermill fits in to his life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a bit more information there. Again, there's a moment where she says to Cooper, oh, you know, you're perfect. And you see the music goes a bit dark and you get a sense that, again, not everything is maybe quite as rosy as we thought with Cooper. Maybe the halo is starting to slip a little bit.
Well, I don't think it's slipping in her eyes, but I think you can almost see that he wants to say out loud, I'm not perfect.
No, well, there's always been this slight sense with Cooper that his chipperness is masking something. Like, you know, we all know those people who are like super positive all the time.
Mm.
And part of you thinks, yeah, you go home and sob, don't you?
Yeah.
Like, you know, when there's no one around.
It's like when we've met people who are just too nice.
Yeah.
It's like, you can't be this nice all
the
time.
Yeah, what do you want? What's going on?
What's wrong with you?
You know, so I think that it's inevitable that you're going to want to deconstruct characters who are like that. We see Bobby getting suited and booted. Another way that Shelley is just like, I just want to go out. I just want to go. And again, you can't blame
Shelley
her.
Shelley is every new mother everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. and she, you know, she's been sort of taken for a bit of a ride here, so you can't blame her. But also, you can see Shelley falling into old ways. The fact that, you know, she liked Bobby because he was kind of the cool rebel guy.
Yeah.
And now things are starting to get domestic. She's like, I want to have fun again. So you almost feel like she's probably going to be on to the next.
Well, she keeps choosing the wrong guys.
Yeah, yeah. You know? And you almost get the feeling that Bobby is probably not going to be the last
of the
bad decisions that she makes.
Mm.
But again, you know, you can't really feel sorry for Bobby because he's like a
self-obsessed. Oh, he couldn't give less of a fuck at the moment.
Yeah, he's just a child. He's literally dressing up as a adult, you know.
He's just play acting. He's playing house.
Yeah, exactly right. And so Catherine goes to see Truman and she asks him if he believes in guardian angels. And again, there's loads of great performance-based sketches of scenes in this episode. We see Dick Tremaine go to see Lucy to tell her that he's enrolled
to Andy in this scenario. Yeah.
He is very...
he is very manly.
Yeah, he's Brennan. Deputy Brennan in this episode.
I love the fact that he waits until he's around the corner talking to Hawk before he looks like he's about to sob.
Yeah, he can't hold it in.
Yeah.
And but we see that Dick Tremaine has enrolled in a Big Brother program as a way of ingratiating himself to Lucy. Cooper says goodbye to Truman and he's...
Nobody helping her with the fucking light bulb.
No. Cooper says goodbye to Truman. And gets made an honorary bookhouse boy. And I love Cooper's I'm honoured beyond my ability to express myself line. And,
I love that line. I thought it was really good.
And I also love, spoiler alert, that Cooper says to Hawk, I hope that if I ever get lost, you will be the man they send to find me.
Yeah.
And he is.
Yeah.
In season 3, he's the one who's sent by the log lady to go to Glastonbury Grove to find Cooper. So... somebody remembered that line of dialogue when they were writing season 3.
Gee, I wonder if it was Mark Frost.
Yeah. We see the Mountie and the FBI agent come in. And it's funny, actually, because that's Clarence Williams III, who is most famous for... he was Peggy Lipton's co-star in The Mod Squad, which was a 1960s TV show. And it was kind of like a precursor to... 21 Jump Street, where it was like teenagers, undercover cops kind of thing. And they were the two leads. And I think there's actually a moment in the next episode where they look at each other in a kind of, But it was Clarence Williams that introduced Peggy Lipton to Quincy Jones.
Oh, right.
In real life. So there's a nice little sort of incestuous thing going on here.
Clarence Jr.
And Clarence Williams also played Prince's dad in Purple Rain.
there you go.
His other great claim to fame. We see Bobby going to try to see Ben. This is where I've got a note about how, and you picked up on this as well earlier, Hannah, these sort of fun, different configurations of characters that they're trying, and I think that's...
I love that Audrey keeps calling Bobby by his full name.
Yeah, Bobby Briggs.
Bobby Briggs.
Yeah, because that's a school thing,
isn't it?
It's
a very school thing. Yeah.
Because you know people's names from hearing them on the register, don't you? And yeah. Like, have you heard the Bobby Briggs fingered Jane Smith behind there? You know, it's that kind of like...
Oh my God.
But the other thing is, as well, is one of the things that I think makes this era of the show different is that, and I think this is David Lynch's absence, and when he returns to the show, they kind of move back, is that you start seeing many of the characters having their iconographical elements removed. Mm. So, for example, Bobby Briggs was always the black leather jacket with the T on the back, with the check shirt tied around his waist.
Yeah.
Cooper, always in the suit.
Yeah.
We're now seeing Bobby Briggs in a suit, and we're now seeing Cooper in, like, flannel shirts.
Yeah.
And there's a soft, there's a relaxing of that element of it.
I mean, and seeing Major Briggs in jeans was really discombobulating
for me. It's, I'll say it now in case I forget, but Gordon Cole comes back in about 7 or 8 episodes' time, and Cooper's the kind of check shirt, groovy, I'm living in Twin Peaks Cooper. And the first line of dialogue that Gordon Cole has is, Cooper, put your suit back on. We're going back. And it's David Lynch coming into the show and going, no. Cooper's meant to look like this always. Bobby Briggs is meant to look like this always. You know, it's the kind of, these aren't people. They're archetypes.
Yeah.
And you can't change them, you know. But it is interesting seeing them having fun with that at this point, you know. Mm. The kind of what I always call the local hero element, the kind of the city slicker going native element of it. It was inevitively going to happen to Cooper at some point.
Of course it was, yeah.
But it does feel like the show's opened up in a lot of ways. And I think that's what I like about this episode is it feels like the show is just, it's jamming. It's just, it's slowed it down. It's not worried about kind of playing to the crowd. I think they realised that the show was probably going to lose its zeitgeist and just become a cult show, you know, and be more like one of those shows, you know, like The Twilight Zone or whatever, and not quite the cultural phenomenon that it was. And I think there's a sense of relief and a kind of good, we don't have to tap dance. We can just...
And sort of get the groove on.
We can just do weird shit with Nadine in the high school and not worry about it, you know. And I get the feeling they kind of wanted to do that all along.
Yeah.
So we
get in the groove. We Madonna in my head now.
we see the Mountie talking about the missing cocaine. The moment where
I get so confused by that guy. It's like, is he good? Is he bad?
What, the Mountie?
Because like who's he ripping off? Is he ripping off? He's trying to frame Cooper, but is he really trying to frame Cooper, or is he trying to get Jean Reno? Is he?
How he was doing a sting operation.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, there's a character in Fire Walk With Me, which of course is a prequel, that looks a lot like that guy as well, and that confused me even more.
Mm.
Like, I remember when I was watching Fire Walk With Me, I was like, it was like 2 years after the show. I'm like, the Mountie guy confusion continues. It's just It never ends. So the one moment, though, I've got to admit, and I'm a big defender of season 2.5 of Twin Peaks, and I do enjoy it, but the one moment where I did think, all right, Twin Peaks, okay, this is, you're pushing about
your cock out away. Here,
is what, sir?
Put your cock away.
No, yeah. All right, mate. Is the bit where Nadine throws that guy, and he keeps spinning in the air.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of like, okay, so we're a cartoon now. And I've said before, you know, Lynch does, I don't know if Lynch isn't involved that much in this episode, but does kind of dumb stuff.
Yeah.
You know, show things like On the Air and Ronnie Rocket and, you know, One Saliva Bubble. Some of the stuff in season 3 gets pretty crazy. But that was a moment where I'm just kind of like, put your cock away. You know? and I get it. I think, but at this point, they're kind of testing the boundaries of the show.
Yeah.
There's another moment as well, and I'll point it out when we get to it in about 3 or 4 episodes time, where it's like, and whenever people do memes that are meant to be having a pop at season 2 of Twin Peaks, there's 2 images that they always show. And one is Nadine throwing that guy. And there's another bit from the Dick and Andy storyline later on, which we'll get to. You'll know it when you see it. But again, they're the things that make it a cult show, because true cult shows have, there's always a slight element of kind of making fun of it a little bit as well. It's our show, so we're allowed to.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, this is a very cult director, but it did remind me a lot of, like, John Waters. It had a real John Waters feel.
Yeah, real kind of like...
Like crybaby feel.
Yeah, like kitschy kind of...
Yeah.
And it's got that whole kind of 50s rock and roll vibe about it as well.
It's very Americana.
Well, there's an element as well of Twin Peaks being influenced by itself, because, I mean, we talked about this watching The X-Files, where The X-Files was such a cultural force in its early seasons that it started to influence pop culture and mainstream culture to the point where in later seasons, when Mulder and Scully are having conversations about, but they're just saying that because that's the media depiction or what people understand from the media of what aliens being. But that's because of The X-Files.
Yeah.
And what you see is that Twin Peaks resulted in a huge interest in independent, alternative and art and transgressive cinema.
Mm.
And so what happened was that gave a boost to filmmakers like John Waters he was going to do June.
Jodorowsky.
And these other filmmakers, it gave them a big boost as well.
Mm.
And I think, I think it paved the way for people like Quentin Tarantino and Kevin Smith and those independent filmmakers who came like 2 or 3 years later than Twin Peaks.
Mm.
And I think that what happened there was those films, like things like more mainstream John Waters films like Serial Mom and Crybaby and stuff like that, they entered into the zeitgeist, and that a feedback loop occurred where you started to see the influence of those on Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of like it influences all this stuff. That stuff permeates into the culture and then comes back into Twin Peaks. And I think a little bit of that you're seeing in stuff like this.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we see Cooper get questioned. We see Truman defending him. And I mean, and Truman...
He's so staunch as well.
Oh, it is. And again, he's the stereotype, you know.
Yeah.
And it is, I mean, you could really easily play into the whole, you know, homoeroticism of that, because their friendship is so earnest.
Yeah.
That the temptation, of course, the quite lazy temptation, if I'm going to be honest, is to sort of go there, because we as audiences seem to not be able to handle male friendship without just taking the piss out of it, basically. Yeah. It's, you know, like Sam and Frodo. It's all of these things. It's a weird kind of cultural toxicity. Of
genuine affection.
What if men are always told, look, you're too toxic, you're too testosterone, but as soon as men show an EV, they're like, oh, well, come on, guys.
Yeah.
You tell me the exact calibration of masculinity that you would prefer, and I would try to adhere to that at just the right point. You know? So we see Leo move a little bit. He moved.
I did think that.
We learn that, and this feels like the slowest reveal ever. Like they actually almost forgot about it, and they were like, "Oh shit, we should probably reveal this." That Norma's mum is M.T. Wentz.
Yeah,
because M.T. Wentz hasn't been mentioned for like 6 episodes.
Yeah,
and it's like they brought her in, and they're obviously like, "Oh, we'll have her be M.T. Wentz," and it's almost as though they just forgot. What I suspect it was I think that it was the we've got to wrap up the Laura Palmer story.
Yeah,
so. All of these storylines are going to get sidelined, so we can just mainline all this shit.
I really love her little speech to her mum about, you know, her feelings are valid and she's allowed to have them and fuck you, Peggy basically. Litton
can do wounded strength.
Yeah.
Like no one.
Yeah.
You know, and it's such a specific lane to be able to play.
I love how she plays it. Just that, that quiet, you know, she's got a core of steel, even though she is emotional.
And also, a lot of it is to do with the way that the actress looks, because, I mean, she's obviously a very beautiful woman, but she's kind of indeterminable in age, in the way that she could be either a very well-preserved older woman or a younger woman who's had a tough life.
Yeah.
Like, she could play either of those really, and it would be completely believable, because there is such an age ambiguity to the way that she looks.
And when she is vulnerable, there is a young quality about her. Like, well, it's almost like her teenage years, all the hurt from Ed and all of that stuff comes back, and you can see it in her.
Well, they say in the episode that Nadine is 33, and her, Ed, Hank, Norma, and Truman were all meant to be in high school together.
Yeah.
So I think it's fair to assume they were all in the same year.
Yeah.
So that means that Norma's meant to be 33.
Yeah.
You know, and it is funny to think.
Fucking hell, at 33, I wasn't.
Well, you didn't own a diner.
No, I didn't.
Where's your diner, honey? You've had years to catch up with that. Then again, I'm not the detective of a small town constabulary yet, am I? So
you should be the fucking mayor by now, if we're going.
But I've had problems with my eye, like Nadine. So I mean, I guess I've achieved one of the things that didn't get a patch, though, unfortunately.
More fool you.
But boys are always trying to look at my skirt in the reflection of my shoes. So.
You purposely don't put any undies on under your skirt. You let your nutsack just hang on out.
Yep, yep. For
everyone to see.
Sun's out, buns out. So Hank and his father-in-law are at One-Eyed Jack's. The guy who plays Ernie, the father-in-law, really reminds me. He's like a cross between British actor Mike Reed and Keith Richards. It's a really weird combination of people. Yeah. He's got that, would you like a cup of tea? Kind of, that was not the best impression I've ever done. But it wasn't the worst. I think you look great.
I mean, they're all.
Cabot. I've got to find my core to get them my greed one. It's like when you do a Yoda impression, you've got to kind of calibrate before you start. And then you've got to go for the words.
And that, listeners, is Mike's sex noise.
Yeah. You can edit them together and relive it. Come on, T. So we see Jean Renault and the Mountie are in cahoots. And this is the scene where I've got a note about how it's a fair cop to say that things are feeling directionless at the moment, because you've got all this stuff happening over here. And I think what it is so many storylines ended at the same time that I think that if they'd have been able to stagger them, it would be fine. But you've got all this stuff happening, and I know that it goes somewhere. Some of it doesn't. Some of it's just funny, quirky, weird Twin Peaks stuff.
Yeah.
But a lot of it does. A lot of it connects. But, you know, not knowing that at the time, you'd be kind of like, well, why are we spending time with Hank and Mike Reed - Keith Richards at One-Eyed Jack's? What the hell? Where's this going? You know, I think that there it is, as much as I love this, it is a legitimate criticism of the show at this point to say that it is flailing. But I think that, fortunately, this show was built to flail.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, okay, I enjoy the environments, the aesthetic, the performance, the music, all of these elements of the shows in their own right. That if they just want to ASMR it for a little bit, that I'm fine with that. You know, but I absolutely understand that many of the 30 million weekly viewers the show had in America weren't, you know. And that's when I think that you kind of separate the men from the boys as far as
you do have to be into that sort of sensibility to be on board with it and okay with letting it find its feet and take its time.
I mean, also, I think that this was where the realization of the reality of making a 22-episode season hit the production.
Mm.
Because most of the people, apart from Mark Frost, who were involved in the show, had little to no experience in making long-run TV shows.
Right.
These were indie filmmakers.
Yeah.
And if you look at the first 8 episodes of season 2 of Twin Peaks, they're paced the same way as the first season, which was only 8 episodes. Mm. And it's almost as though they got to the end of 8 episodes and were like, shit, we've got to keep doing this?
Yeah.
How'd you do that? We've never done that before. And you can see that.
Another 14 to go.
Yeah, you know, and I think it is tempting and largely correct to blame a lot of it on the fact that the show got sabotaged with the storyline a little bit. But I think some of it also, one of the great things about Twin Peaks is that it was made by people who didn't normally make television shows.
Mm.
The lunatics got to run the asylum.
Yeah.
You know, they handed over a network television show to a bunch of film students, essentially.
Yeah.
But what comes with that is somewhat of a lack of discipline.
Mm.
And I think you see that a bit at this point.
Yeah.
But if that's the price, all right.
Yeah, but think about when the original Star Wars was made. There was a lack of discipline there too.
It was a bunch of stoners, basically. Yeah,
who were all having fun hanging out together, but, you know, there wasn't a lot of productivity going on.
No, but they were young people, so they didn't have to be home at 5 o'clock to go and look after the kids, so that they'd work all night.
Yeah,
you know. So I guess it's the differences. So when you watch Twin Peaks, you get the feeling that one of the big fundamental differences between a show like Twin Peaks and a show like you know, Dallas or the A-Team or anything like that, is that you get the feeling when you see interviews with people who are making Twin Peaks that it was a mission.
Mm.
You know, that was their mission and it meant something. Whereas a lot of TV shows that I like, it was a job.
Well, you know? I could write an episode of Dallas and then I woke up.
I would like you to write an episode of Dallas.
It would be quite the incredible knot of dribble.
Well, I'll be like, I don't remember Dallas being quite as explicitly pornographic as this, but I don't think this was. You're like, I ran out of ideas, Mike.
Yeah, don't you remember Debbie Does Dallas?
Hey! Yeah, there we go. you meant the brief. So Josie appears to Truman. And Cooper and Briggs are in the woods talking about Bob. And again, it's that thing where even though, you know, there's a lot of silliness in this episode, you've got all of the stuff with Nadine, you've got all the stuff with Bobby and Ben Horn, who's looking a bit disheveled, which we should probably mention.
Oh, he's declining seriously.
He's eating tubs of ice cream in his sweatpants, isn't he, at this point?
Very much so.
And we, you know, and we've got all this stuff going on, but as soon as night falls, you know,
it's a dodgy place.
It's like Babylon. It could be a dangerous place.
It is. It could be a dangerous
and,
place.
And you know, we get Cooper and Briggs talking about Bob, and Briggs says, in what, with hindsight, we know, of course, is foreshadowing that some men's fate is to face the darkness, and that if we face it with kind of imperfect courage or fear, fear makes us vulnerable to the darkness. And, you know, and I think, I mean, that's a great thing in literature, you know, the idea that if you don't believe, if your faith isn't stout, you will fail. But I think that that's a really good life lesson in general, because if you look at fear, what fear generally results in is things like racism.
Mm.
You know, if you look at, you know, 9/11, and then straight after that, you'd hear about, you know, racist attacks on Indian taxi drivers in New York.
Yeah.
And how fear can be politicized and used.
Of course it can. Look at Trump. Look at Hitler.
Yeah, well, I mean, even before, I mean, rainmakers, you know, people who would come in and would exploit people's fear of the drought, you know, and give them easy answers. Advertising, you know, the whole basis of advertising is fear of being ugly or unsuccessful or unhealthy or, you know, all of these kind of things. So the idea in story and in mythology of imperfect courage being one's downfall is not just a mythological lesson, but it's actually kind of a useful life lesson, because generally speaking, and I say this about myself, most of the dumbest things I've done in my life have been motivated by fear of some kind.
You know? Some of mine have been. Most were related to the consumption of alcohol.
Well, it was your fear of sobriety. Your fear of having to deal with the world in uninebriated.
Future Hannah's problems.
No, exactly. But if you trace it back far enough, it always comes back to fear. You know, and that's what Briggs is saying here.
Yeah.
And he makes an overture about something called the White Lodge, which will come back into the storyline in quite a significant manner. And I love the way that it almost feels like it's played as a genre thing. When Cooper's like, oh, I need to go to the Call of Nature.
Yeah.
And when he said, oh, there's nothing quite like the sensation of urinating in the open air, I'm thinking, God, our son would like you with his bush wheeze.
His bush wee, yeah.
But it's the way that Cooper's like...
Louis's got a lot to answer.
But Cooper says to Briggs, but you will have to tell me more about... He's like, oh, we're going to go to urinate, but then you will have to tell me more about this White Lodge. And
tell
he walks
me
off.
More, tell me
and,
more.
No, but he walks off and then he stops and he's like, when I return. Like, he's like, he's milking the whole, I'll call her when I get back thing. It's like they sort of play up to it.
Yeah.
And then we see some ominous music.
You totally think he's going to wee all over his shoes and fry.
We see an owl appear and we get a bright light. And then just like that. And then Briggs is gone. So any final thoughts before we wrap things up?
It had such an X-Files ending. I kind of forgot what show we were watching for a minute.
And you remember I said in the last episode that when the X-Files came out and people were comparing it to the X-Files, I really feel like it's this run. Yeah. I mean, Duchovny's going to come into the X-Files in the next couple of episodes as well. Into Twin Peaks. As like, you know, an FBI agent. So, I mean, the connections become really kind of crazy. But it is funny because we are obviously, you know, concurrently watching the X-Files to sort of see. We're now into the 2000s era of the X-Files. And, of course, this was the early 90s. So it's interesting from a pop cultural archaeology perspective to be watching these two shows simultaneously. Mm. But
they are two great shows to watch at the same time, actually. They go very, very well together.
Yeah, they do. They do. Any final thoughts, Hannah?
No, just a very interesting episode, and I'm looking forward to seeing what they come up with in the next one.
Yeah, and I'd say, you know, if I would hope that you're not watching Twin Peaks for the first time, because we do spoiler all these sort of things, but if you are, or if you are rewatching Twin Peaks for the first time, maybe in a long time, maybe for the first time since it's being on, and your memories are a little bit hazy, what I would say is go with it at this point in the show.
Absolutely.
You know, enjoy the fact that the show doesn't go on forever. You know, there are a limited number of these episodes. It does pick up and go back into, you know, full-on Lynchian territory. Mm. So just kind of, you know, kick your shoes off and, you know, pop your clothes on the chair and just enjoy the fact that we get this 4 or 5 episode run where we just get to kind of hang out in the town and have these great little short films. So what are we talking about next time, Anne?
The next episode is called Masked Ball. Synopsis says, Mrs. Briggs talks about her husband's disappearance into the woods. Nadine is put on the wrestling team where she falls for Mike Nelson.
That sounds like a quality subplot.
Oh, yes. James is hired by the mysterious, wealthy Evelyn Marsh.
Oh, it's the notorious Evelyn storyline. Here we go. Strap yourselves in.
Dick takes on an orphan, Little Nicky. It's directed by Dwayne Dunham and written by Barry Pullman.
Alrighty, okay. A quick reminder that we appreciate feedback at rewatchprojectpodcast@gmail.com. Comments on YouTube also are very appreciated. At rewatchproj on Instagram and Twitter. Check out our friend shows and reviews on Spotify and Apple Podcasts are very much appreciated. We will be back very soon. Farewell.
Bye-bye.